Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald and Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the DC metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we're talking with Deborah Fazier-Smith about the COVID-19 pandemic and its effects on workers' compensation claims and laws. Deborah is chair of JGL's Workers' Compensation and Insurance Group. Over the past 35 years, Deborah has represented over 22,000 clients with injuries from workplaces as well as personal injuries due to negligence. She currently sits on a public appointed post as a member of the Senate House Oversight Committee in the Maryland Legislature, which oversees all legislation on workers' compensation and employee benefits, as well as the Workers' Compensation Commission. She has received many awards in her career for law and public service, such as Leaders in the Law by the Daily Record and Top 100 Women on two separate occasions. Benchmark rated her a Top 150 Woman Litigator, and she has been selected by her peers for the best lawyers in America for several years in a row now. Deborah, thanks for joining us today. I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
Thank you for having me, David.
So let's jump right in, Deborah, and let's talk about this pandemic. And we know it's affected everyone's lives in different ways. So let's talk about your specialty. How does COVID-19 and how has it affected what you do, how you represent your clients, and how do you think it's going to continue to affect the workers' compensation practice going forward?
The excellent topic of the moment, isn't it? I have always contended, you know, having worked in this field for so long, that workers' compensation was never regarded as the socioeconomic engine that it really is. There's probably an agreement now that we're having major paradigm shifts all across the board. And somehow we're going to have to allocate the economic burden. Governments are already in crisis. And so I think there's going to be a lean on the private sector to pick up this enormous liability. Governments, especially the states, are going to have these decisions to make, unbelievable, terms of unemployment, protection for frontline people, and helping out the small businesses. So in workers' compensation, let's look at Maryland, where we practice mostly. Maryland, just like other states, we have traditionally had special statuses, what we call presumptions. These have been for our police, our firefighters, EMTs, correction officers. For an example, let me give you an example. High blood pressure, certain cancers, they're presumed compensable on the job. And then the presumption can be rebutted by evidence of the employer, but generally we give them this presumption. So now here comes COVID. What do we do with COVID-19? Generally, when you get a flu or a cold virus at the job, that's not compensable because you could contract a cold anywhere. So now we have this COVID flu type, horrible, horrible type of illness. So what do we do? And it creates a very stark picture for us because of the illness it brings, because of the death. And the frontline workers, whether they're going to be nurses, healthcare providers, doctors, even janitorial workers are essential for us. How do we close this situation?
Yeah, let me interrupt you if it's okay, because it raises an interesting question. Let's say, for example, I'm a frontline worker and I come to you because I acquired the virus probably during the course of my doing my job, whether it's at a hospital or EMT or whatever it might be. I was in the hospital for 60 or 75 days on a respirator. Now I had to go to rehab. I missed a ton of work. Oh, you know, how do you help someone like that who's in that situation, given the ebb and flow of what's going on in your area of the law?
Right. And we see that a lot since I have represented the front line for almost, you know, over 35 years. Let me just backtrack a moment to tell you that I have done an analysis of the state-by-state response on this throughout the nation. And every state appears to be grappling with these questions right now. The main issue will be whether or not it will be the judiciary or the legislature or both that will have the final word on how all these claims are handled. My recent review looks at maybe, it looks like from Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Connecticut, Illinois, Kentucky, Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Missouri, North Dakota, Vermont, Washington, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. They have all taken some kind of action already.
What do you mean by that? For the folks out there, what does that mean when you say they've taken action?
Either the governor has issued some kind of an executive order, or there has been some kind of state legislature mandate that will say, look, we're going to protect you guys. All you have to do is file the claim. We're going to presume that it's compensable under the law, or they have different other criteria. Maryland is one of the states that so far has not acted, not at all. The commission has been brilliant, led by a very, very fluent leader, our chairman, Carl Allman, and has reopened the commission very safely and has given workers all of these months of the ability to bring their case forward, which has been tremendous in a very safe and efficient manner. But we haven't acted as to this presumption. So I sit on the Senate Oversight Committee, as you said, and we will review, hopefully, in January, when the session opens in some format, I'm not sure exactly how, that we could possibly pass something that would give these workers a presumption so that they don't have a difficult path in trying to bring the case. You asked me specifically if someone came to us right now, because there is no legislation, we will handle each case individually. We will file the claim. We will get the medical documentation. We will ask a physician for a causation relationship because we need a physician to tell us how this was contracted. And hopefully we can still use the Maryland standard of medical probability for workers' comp and not necessarily a certainty. But these are all new issues. These are very, very new issues that everyone's going to be dealing with. And in my opinion, if we could come together as a community, as workers' comp in Maryland, the plaintiff and defense bar have had an excellent relationship. We always work together in a crisis. We always figure out the best road to follow. And I think we can do the same thing here. I really do.
So to follow up on that, Deborah, you're going to file my claim and you're going to take the position, obviously, that the illness, the COVID illness that I contracted, I contracted at work due to the job that I had and so forth. And so then do you go to the doctor that treated me or one of the physicians who would sign a certificate? Is that how it works in order for you to pursue that claim?
Yes. In Maryland, you still need medical evidence to a degree of medical probability to come forward. But like I said, I hope and I can only imagine that we're going to make this a little simpler to certain claims. I'll give you an example. I was contacted by an airline personnel who had traveled on a flight and contracted COVID. And the airline, without going into specifics, told her that she was entitled to COVID pay and all the benefits and the time until she was recuperated and can come back to work. But then she filed the workers' compensation claim and they denied it. Hmm. So the employers do not yet have a response, is what I'm saying. So we're very, very early on. But this whole COVID pandemic has brought on two other, I think, very fascinating areas of workers' comp.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, I think workers' comp, people are going to finally recognize how important our segment is. I'll give you an example. Right now, very interesting, I'm following the timeline of a case going on in California having to do with Uber and Lyft. And you know, they are founders, they actually founded the company in California. That's where all their investment capital was, want to keep the, quote, gig economy out of the hands of workers' comp.
What's that mean?
Well, our new gig economy is all these service connections, okay? So they're like a hybrid. They're not exactly the employer that we know traditionally. They arrange these apps to allow people to work when they want, but they have to work within certain criteria. So Maryland, for example, I was very proud of Maryland, actually. The Public Service Commission that regulates, for example, taxis, they came back with something that regulates the drivers, but it wasn't exactly defining whether they were independent contractors or if they were employees. And if they were employees, then they're entitled to workers' compensation. And that is what California, the government of California, is trying to do now. They passed what's called AB 5. AB 5 in California said that you cannot be an independent contractor with, except for certain exceptions. And now the Uber and Lyft people have proposed something called Proposition 22, which would allow Uber to continue as they are operating. And that's going to be, I guess, on their ballot. But in between, the most interesting part, and the whole nation, I'm sure, is watching this because it'll affect all the other states. The California lower courts ruled that they were employees, they were subject to taxes, and they were allowed to have workers' compensation benefits, and they were not independent contractors. The interesting part is that although the state itself wants the revenue, wants the taxes as employees, et cetera, a lot of the independent drivers don't want to be classified as employees because they want the independence. It's very interesting. The unions are trying to weigh in and want them as employees. There's a mix in this situation, and it'll be interesting what happens because Uber and Lyft threatened to leave and shut down based on this decision that the lower court rendered. And in a last minute stay, the court, the appellate court, stayed the action. And they are now in limbo, and the court gave them until October to do their arguments.
So that's interesting. So let me ask you this. So unlike other situations that you may have or may have seen with a class of employees or class, I shouldn't say employees slash independent contractors. In this particular instance, you've got this group of folks who drive Uber or Lyft, but who are taking different perspectives, right, on whether they'd rather be classified as an employee or an independent contractor. Is that right?
Exactly. And you know what's the most interesting is what I predicted many years ago, and I believe that's the road that's going to happen. Remember how I said that, you know, workers' comp is a community that kind of works together on problems, plaintiff and defense? Well, interesting enough, I think the dynamics here, and we'll see how California plays out, and we'll see what Maryland decides to do. But I think you're going to see something very interesting. You're going to see a hybrid. You're not going to see a definite employee situation or an independent contractor. You're going to have a hybrid new designation because of the gig economy that will, in part, give some benefits to these workers from the company. In other words, it's a matter of social policy that these people should be covered for certain things, right? But on the other hand, it's going to treat them more independently when it comes to taxes and the control factor. In Maryland, we have always determined whether someone in workers' comp is an employee by the word control. Who has the control? If the person who's paying you has the control of telling you when to go, what to do, what tools to do, there's certain factors. There's many. But that would mean that they would determine how your status. But in this situation, what I think you're going to see is that they're going to remain autonomous, but there's going to be some kind of regulation. Let me give you an example. One of the things they're trying to do is franchise the employee-employer relationship and keep the Uber rubric over all of them. I don't know if that's really going to work because franchises run a little differently. And I don't know who's going to want to accept the liability as the employer. But it's just something that's being thrown out there. And I think over time, it'll work out. And I think that's a wise decision that the court's giving them some time until October. We'll see. But there's so much money at stake that it's a hard-fought battle.
So let me ask you this, Deborah. I mean, as I'm listening to you, I'm wondering, so, you know, I'm a Lyft or an Uber driver. Why not just give me the choice? Why not say, okay, listen, you can be an independent contractor. This is what you get. This is what you're not going to get. You could be an employee. This is what you're going to get. This is what you're not going to. Let me, as an adult, decide which I want to do. Which way I want to do. Why are the courts and the legislatures twisting themselves all up over this? And why not just give an individual the option?
In a perfect world, that sounds wonderful, but I don't think that it's going to be realistic due to the size of the enormity of the issue. In other words, you're talking about millions and millions of dollars and so many different people that would be even harder. That would be a nightmare to regulate. And if we're talking about trying to get a consensus between the parties, I think we need a path, you know? And that just leads me to, I don't know how much time we have, David, but I also wanted to comment on the last new aspect that the COVID-19 has affected on workers' comp.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
In the past, there has always been a recognition that if an employer designates that an employee can work from home, and that employee has designated a certain spot within that home that is their office, that employee, if unfortunately has an accident within that space, could file workers' comp. Now, obviously, we haven't had to see a lot of that, right? But now I think we're going to have to look into this a little bit closer, because it is a part of, and it could open up a Pandora's box against employers if they're not careful. I think that you're going to see employers set really, really tight regulations on how the workplace would be set within a home.
How can you require an employer to oversee what happens in someone's home? I mean, how is that even practical, you know, going forward?
It's not a matter of that. It's more of, let me give you an example. We have a case in Maryland. I used to call it the bubble bath case. It's one of my favorite cases, and my friend John Noble, a great attorney, defense attorney, handled it, where a woman was traveling. And I think she was in Canada, I'm not sure, on business. And she had to be there, and she had to stay overnight. And she took a bath, and she tripped and fell in the bathtub. I mean, there's nobody supervising her, but that case was deemed compensable because she had to take that work-related job trip. So there's little cases like that throughout the law, sprinkled throughout, that I think might develop as we proceed to have work at home situations and more remote. I know that a lot of employers may cut back on office space and say, hey, I want you to work from home, but you're only allowed to work within your den. You know, when you're working in your den, that's considered your workspace. You go to the garage, you slip on oil. That's obviously nothing to do.
It just seems to me that based on what you're saying, it can impose significant concerns on any employer who allows their employee to work at home, no matter what the rules might be. If I'm in my den and I'm working away, and because I didn't adequately, I put too many books on my bookshelf, and the bookshelf falls over and clobbers me in the head while I'm sitting there, why should that be the employer's concern?
Well, again, you have to go back because there's still many layers of proof. I'm just saying that they would be able to bring their claim. They're still going to have to prove causation, okay? They're still going to have their medical proof, and they are going to be subject to the same defenses they would, such as horseplay, you know, failure to follow procedures at work, the same kind of thing. But I just think it's just another interesting aspect that the pandemic has caused us to look at. That's all.
This has all really, really been interesting, Deb. And I want to thank you so much for being here today. You've raised some very, very cool issues that I imagine a lot of us as either employers or employees that have not thought about. Now, Lynn, if someone who's listening in wants to get a hold of you and ask questions like this, or may have a case that they want to talk about, What's the best way for them to get hold of you?
Yes, we're getting very busy. But, you know, I've been passionate about this area for, you know, 35 years, and I'm very, very ready to handle this load of new types. And I think that people really need to know what their rights are. Our group office number is 240-553-1173. And if there's a recording on it and you leave it, if we can't just pick up at that moment, we'll call you right back.
And can folks email you directly? And how do they do that?
Absolutely. That's actually a very good way. It's my three initials, D, F, like Frank, S, like Sam, at jgllaw.com.
Deborah, again, thank you so much for your time today. This has really been terrific. Thanks to everyone out there for listening in. Please join us for our next episode. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.